Welcome, everybody, to another fabulous Monday night RFRX Talk. I'm your host, Kara, and I am here with the fantastic Sasha D'Souza. Sasha, how are you?
I'm great. I'm doing well. Welcome to everybody. How are you being, Kara?
I am doing well. I'm actually recording from a different location than usual. I'm on vacation this week, and I am loving it.
Wonderful. Whereabouts? Anywhere exciting near the coast, in the mountains?
I'm in the mountains in Colorado, and it is lovely. It's beautiful, and it's not 110 degrees, which is awesome.
Fantastic. Oh, that sounds beautiful.
Yes. And how are things in your neck of the woods?
Yeah, well, we've had a lot of things happen in Australia, as usual. We've had a very, very wet few months on the East Coast. We've had flooding in so many parts of Australia, huge amounts of damage. So many people have been affected, sadly. And we're expecting perhaps another few months of issues. Today's a beautiful day, but who knows what it will bring. But yeah, there's been a lot of people doing it tough out here in Australia recently.
Oh, I'm sorry to hear that. It sounds like that's kind of going on everywhere lately. So we will do our best to make it through, but glad you're doing okay. And that everybody here has been able to join us. Without further ado, let me go ahead and introduce our guest tonight, who I am super excited for. Tonight, we're going to be hearing from our very own Sherry D'Souza, who is not only an RFR board member, the chair for RFR Australia, international development director for RFR, wife to co-host Sasha, you may have noticed a similar last name, and is also a former Jehovah's Witness. And we're going to hear a lot more about that. So Sherry, take it away. Thank you for joining us.
Well, thank you so much for having me. I am feeling quite privileged to be doing this. And after all of those rather audacious titles that you just announced, feels quite surreal. But what we're going to be discussing today is a bit about my story and also Sasha's story. So we're going to have a pretty relaxed chat about our journey out of religion. But the whole idea, I suppose, is to offer hope to couples that find themselves in this kind of situation, and to also provide some tools and information and resources of what worked for us and what really helped us navigate the situation we found ourselves in a few years ago. But to understand that, you need to know a little bit about us first. So I have prepared some slides, which I am now going to go to. And let's start this presentation from the beginning. Okay. So my name is Sherry D'Souza, and I was raised third generation Jehovah's Witness. My father was also raised a Jehovah's Witness, whereas my mother converted at the age of 19. She was quite vulnerable at that point in her life. She'd had quite a lot of trauma throughout her childhood, and most notably an older brother that she was very close to died by suicide. And so when the witnesses told her about their teaching of resurrection and that she would have the chance to see her brother again, she latched onto that and studied with the witnesses, met my father. The rest goes from there. So I came along only about 18 months after my parents were married. And being raised as a Jehovah's Witness child is a fairly intense experience. And I was quite a serious child as well. I felt very keenly my responsibility as the older sibling to set a good example to my younger sister, as I was told on nearly a daily basis. And when I got to school, I was the only Jehovah's Witness in school as well. So school did not feel like a safe environment, and it didn't also feel like a learning environment, because what was drummed into you at such a young age is that you were to view school as your own special territory, and that you had the opportunity to preach to other children and teachers as well, that the normal door-to-door knocking ministry wasn't going to reach. So, and I felt that very keenly as a young child. So had to do this dance between wanting to be popular, not being able to spend time with any classmates because they weren't witnesses, but also trying to preach to them so that they had an opportunity to not be killed at Armageddon. It's all very a heavy load for children to have on their shoulders at such a young age. I can remember after the annual conventions that the witnesses have, usually at each convention there are new releases, new books or publications that have been produced by the organisation, basically more propaganda tools. But we would be very excited at these new new releases of literature. And I have vivid memories in my primary school years, so not too much older than that photo of me in the green dress, actually. Yeah, it would have been around that age, that my mother would prepare a presentation for me to share with the teacher after the convention. And so I had to summon up my courage as a, you know, 9, 10, 11, 12 year old, and go up to the teacher after class and tell them about the convention and give them a book, whatever the book was that had been released. And I felt the pressure to do that, and I did do that. And I realise now the teachers were very kind in listening to me and in taking the literature. But I suppose the best way I can describe school was that you saw it first as an opportunity to preach to others. The learning and education part was secondary to that. So when I turned 9, I remember vividly a assignment that we'd been given at school of what were you going to be when you grow up? And as you can imagine with kids, you've got the boys thinking about being firemen and policemen, and the girls thinking about being nurses or teachers, very gender stereotypical roles. Whereas I took the question very seriously and thought, well, what do I want to do when I grow up? And at around this time, we had a circuit assembly, which was a two-day assembly that the Jehovah's Witnesses have quite frequently. They have two throughout the year. And at that assembly were individuals who had become full-time servants for the organisation, devoting 90 hours a month of going door-to-door, preaching to people about the Bible and conducting Bible studies. And they spoke about, these two that were interviewed, they spoke about how much joy they had in being these regular pioneers and in teaching people about the Bible. That I was like a little 9-year-old impressionable going, that's what I'm going to do. I'm going to be a regular pioneer when I grew up. And so I did my whole assignment on being a regular pioneer. And so that's ended up what I did do. I got baptized at 14 and left school in year 10. So didn't complete high school education and became a regular pioneer at 16. Now,
Jerry, it's almost as if you're the propaganda from this insular religious world controlled what it was that you thought and what you were going to do with your life. Am I being too cynical there?
No, you are not being too cynical at all. At all. And I mean, it's hard in a few minutes to try to describe the first 15 to 20 years of your life, of how much it formed your identity.
But you didn't know anything but that, did you?
No, you had nothing else to compare it to. And I can remember the manipulation that was used. For example, on the very rare occasions where one of the kids at school actually wanted to spend time with me and they might have asked me to, you know, come around to my place after school and we can play. And like any other kid, you're like, oh, someone wants to have play with me, and yes, I'd love to do that. But of course, you've got to ask the parents, and you know what your parents are going to say. You just know it. But the craftiness of the organization in the way it manipulates situations like this, which you're going to see shortly, I've got a video for you. But if I had the courage to ask my parents and say, oh, Vanessa's asked me to go around after school and play, my father would sit me down and say, well, Sherry, that's very nice that they want to spend time with you, but do they love Jehovah? And of course, you're forced to say, well, no, they don't. And so the next follow-up question was, well, if they don't love Jehovah, should you be spending time with them? And you're forced to be the person to say no. So it's not even the parent telling you, no, you can't go around to Vanessa's place. You're telling yourself. You're manipulated into this situation. So I suppose you're almost gaslighting yourself. It's, yeah.
Wow, that's incredible. And this starts at as soon as you can be old enough to ask if you can go over to a friend's house. They've already got you answering the questions.
Yes.
Wow.
Yes.
And I suppose if you were to, you know, say rebelliously, well, yes, I should hang out with them, I assume that would not be an acceptable response.
No. And
well, it all comes down to one thing, Sherry. How were those who were outside of the Jehovah's Witness faith described, and how were we taught to think of them?
Well, that's it. I mean, they're worldly people. And
worldly is not a good word. Like we think of the word worldly means educated, travel, dignified.
Worldly wise.
Worldly meant evil, to be feared, to be
correct. Correct. Like any high control group, Jehovah's Witnesses have loaded language where one word or two words pack a lot of meaning into it. Worldly was definitely one of them. So it being a very black and white religion, you are either in the truth or you are out of the truth. If you are not in the religion, you are worldly, and anything that is worldly is outside of the organization, and therefore by default it's influenced by Satan.
So
it literally does become as black and white as that. And so when you as a child are going to school, you are mixing with the world out of necessity because you're going to school, but you are constantly made aware that you are surrounded by this worldly influence that is Satan inspired, and that, you know, the kids at school are, you know, they might be lovely children, but they're not serving Jehovah, and therefore that means it naturally puts them into Satan's camp.
And that there was always an ulterior motive, wasn't there, Sherry, that our teachers were teaching us, but they might be slipping in satanic propaganda, or children might be kind to us and offer us candy, but it might be because they want to take us away from God. So we're kind of raised in this very suspicious mentality of everybody, mm-hmm. that the kindest it's act helpful. Was actually viewed with suspicion.
Yeah.
And were you expected to reveal to the other students and the teachers that this was your opinion of them? Like, did they know that your opinion was, well, you're not part of my belief, and therefore, you know, I'm not going to be able to socialize with you. I am worried that you're, you know, possessed by Satan or influenced.
You won't say it as outright as that, but it's present in every single day of being at school. So, for example, because it's commonly known about Jehovah's Witnesses don't celebrate birthdays, Christmas, Easter, any celebration really. So when you think of normal school activities, when those events come around, you know, there are exercises that teachers will have for the children so that they can, you know, make the most of those celebrations. We were not to be involved in any of that. So you are set aside and you're different from everybody else in that you cannot participate in those things.
Mother's Day, Father's Day,
Valentine's Day, literally any celebration you can think of, or any event, commemoration. So like Veterans Day in the States, Thanksgiving in Australia, Anzac Day, Australia Day, any of those, like that's that's patriotic and nationalistic, so you're not involved with that either, even down to singing of the national anthem. And if there is a school song or school anthem, you cannot participate in that either. And so I remember once a week we would have school assembly, and at school assembly we'd be singing the national anthem and you'd salute the flag. Well, I couldn't participate in either of those two activities. And so you constantly feel different.
Yeah.
All the time different. And you just, so, and at nine, I know my classmates, they didn't know what to do with me. They just didn't know what to do with me. They didn't know how to relate. I didn't know how to relate to them. And so I had no friends at the age of nine, and I literally sat by myself at recess and lunch. It was intensely lonely, but I would tell myself, I'd pray, and I'd tell myself that I had all of the angels as friends.
Oh.
You just couldn't see my friends because they were invisible. And look, oh, freaking tragic, but.
That makes me so sad. And it sounds like that is by design.
Yeah.
It's not accidental that you didn't have any friends. That was the point of all of this. How awful.
Yeah. So that was really my childhood that shaped a lot of who I became and the decisions that I would later make. So that's enough about me. Let's go to the next slide. Isn't he cute?
Sasha.
He's about the same age. He's six in this photo, and I was six in the photo just before. But now, Sasha, why don't you share with everybody what your background was and what school was like for you, and take it away.
Yeah, thanks. So, yeah, fairly quickly, very similar upbringing to what Sherry described. So in my case, my father is, well, I was third generation Jehovah's Witness. The picture that's on the slide there is my father is the little boy there, and then that's my uncle, my grandfather, my grandmother, very devout witnesses. So I, along with Sherry, but in my case possibly a little bit more, had the expectation to keep that generational faith going within the Jehovah's Witness faith, and no doubt for many of us watching here, regardless of what faith we're from, there's an expectation that you need to keep that family spiritual line going. You need to make sure that you are being as respectful of the faith that you are privileged to be born into. So similar school environment. I always struggled because I wanted to have friends, but I realized that people in the world were always out to take me away from Jehovah. Terrible environment for young children to be raised in. And yet it's not unique to Jehovah's Witnesses. Many insular religious organizations and cults went through that. So I tried to do my best. And I guess the other thing is we trust our parents when we're being raised. That's inherently how humans are. We trust that our parents are telling us, you know, not to run on the road, not to touch the hot stove. Oh, and our faith is the only true faith. So we kind of believe them because we don't know anything but that. And then in the process of that, there's a huge expectation to make your parents happy, to be the best possible child that you can be. And of course, that means conforming with all of the behavior. And so very much like cult specialists will talk about, there's the BITE model: behavior control, information control, thought control, and emotion control. And that applied to us as little kids growing up in this environment. Everything was regulated. All of those BITE of the BITE model was regulated. And we had a lot of stress. I think when I look back at my childhood now, I see that I was happy, but I was also a kid who was under a lot of constant stress, because not only were my parents always watching, but God was always watching me. Mm-hmm. So anything I thought, anything I said, anything, I just wanted to be a happy kid. But you had that expectation that this is not our real life. This is just our trial run before the proper paradise happens in the future. And so don't get so involved with things now. So basically, that expectation is put on us that you couldn't be that happy, carefree child that all children deserve to be.
And so this is kind of the reasoning that makes it okay, the justification for why, you know, you're making your children not have friends and not be able to socialize. It's not that bad because this isn't really the time that matters. It's after your death. Yep. Wow.
Well, no. So difference with Jehovah's Witnesses, it's not a paradise is not something that you get after you die. They actually don't believe in an immortal soul. They believe that you are a living, breathing human and that the soul is intrinsic with that process, that breathing process. So they don't believe in a separate entity at all.
And so you're resurrected?
Yes, yeah, correct.
Life now in this present world is temporary. This is Satan's world, but very soon, this is the nutshell, 30-second elevator speech. Any day now, God is going to step in and destroy everybody who is not one of Jehovah's Witnesses. Every part of this satanic system of things will be destroyed at Armageddon. Only those who are deemed righteous will be able to live forever and ever on a paradise earth, never getting sick, never dying, and we will live forever on this earth made up of Jehovah's Witnesses, where the whole system of things will be completely new. And that's basically the Jehovah's Witness teaching. Only 144,000 humans will go up to heaven to rule as the government, but every other human will live forever on earth, and everybody who's died, who's deemed to be faithful or deemed worthy by God, will be resurrected and restored to a perfect life on earth. That's their sales pitch in a nutshell.
At that point in time, and when the perfect new world arrives, there won't be any need for witnessing and door knocking anymore, right?
Well, there will be for those that are resurrected who come from other periods of time where they haven't had an opportunity to be witnessed to and have made a choice. So they will come back. Billions will be resurrected.
So you will continue to have the
and
idea
then they'll need to be taught
lifestyle.
Yes, so they need to then be taught. They have multiple judgment days. So you've got the first judgment day at Armageddon, and then in 1,000 years time after that, there is a second judgment where Satan is let out of the abyss. This is all from Revelation, according to them. Satan's let out of the abyss to tempt as many as he can in his final act of disobedience and rebellion. And then after the earth is cleansed of that, then we're done and dusted. And everyone then lives forever.
Okay.
But inherent with all of that too, and intrinsic with all that, is the fact that, again, that stress is on you, that you can never be assured of your salvation. Yeah. Either now, while you're on earth, because, you know, any day you might slip. Even when you get across the line in paradise after Armageddon, you could be at any time deemed unworthy if you fail. So that constant pressure to be deemed worthy is always there. After that 1,000-year judgment, you know, be careful of those who are resurrected back on earth as you're preaching to somebody from the 1600s who they might take you away from your relationship with God. So there's a constant fear that you're not worthy, that you could slip, and that you could be deemed worthy of judgment. So
And what Sasha's just described, right, is now with the advent of video technology, they have actually done demonstrations or dramas of exactly that, of what it will be like after Armageddon and preaching to someone from another time period. They've actually play acted that out.
Oh my goodness. So it's not even just, you know, hey, we need to become culturally competent and be able to speak to people from all different backgrounds. You have to know how to talk to people from different times. Like,
Do you have to
learn like old English? Like, is everybody going to...
No, they actually believe that everybody will speak one united language after the resurrection. I mean, we could go down the rabbit hole of crazy
Esperanto, teachings. Right?
Yeah, that's it. but with the religious flair,
My goodness. Wow.
I think it demonstrates, and I think why we're laboring this is because being raised in this environment impacts on the decisions that you then make. Mm-hmm. So for Sasha, he was baptized at 16. He did complete his schooling, and then he went to become a regular pioneer at 18. But do you want to explain to everybody what Bethel is?
Yeah. So I went to finished high school, year 12. I took up the regular pioneer ministry. I thought that was the right thing to do. We are never encouraged in the Jehovah's Witness environment to pursue a career. Work is just something you do to pay the bills. And so you do that generally in menial jobs. There's no higher education encouraged. In fact, university education is discouraged actively because, you know, you might be tempted away from the faith by this worldly environment. So as a result, you've got a lot of fairly mid-educated people working menial jobs just to get by because this is not the real life. So I did that. I did, you know, window cleaning, part-time sales jobs. But at 19, I had the privilege to be invited to the headquarters of Jehovah's Witnesses, which was in Sydney. Now, I grew up on the West Coast in Perth, so that meant travelling across the other side of Australia, first time out of home. And I lived and worked on site for 5 years at the headquarters. There was 500 odd people there at the time. And that was basically the headquarters for all the Asia Pacific area. The printing of the publications, the administrative centre was there for the preaching work. They had workshops, they had buildings for building furniture and materials to support the Jehovah's Witness machine, you might say. So I lived and worked there, worked with the housekeepers. I enjoyed my time there. But I also realized that it was a very insular environment. You know, it wasn't like the fun environment that a normal 19 to 24 year old might enjoy going to university or anything like that. Because again, you had the constant expectation to be the model person within the religion, mm-hmm. how you dressed, what your grooming was like, how you conduct your conversations, everything like that was always strictly monitored. And so whilst I enjoyed my time there, I could see too that it just serve to reinforce that whole cult or high control thinking, that mindset. So basically since birth onwards, we were being molded into the people that we are expected to be. So who are we? Who were we? You know, we didn't really know our real personality or our real pursuits or hobbies or anything like that, because it was all being dictated to us through that environment.
Wow. It's like you're literally being turned into little robots for for the organization.
Yes.
Oh, that's horrifying.
Of course, you don't realize it at that degree at that point, but to really sort of hammer this point home, I'm just going to stop the share to get to a short video that I want to play for everybody.
While you're finding that, this is the culture of Jehovah's Witnesses. They now have created a whole series of cartoon propaganda videos for their younger ones who are being born. They call it the Caleb and Sophia series. If anyone is ever brave enough, go to the official JW.org website and you'll see all these videos. A lot of them are in kind of the Pixar animation style, and they have messages that are very much full of indoctrination.
Yeah. So please forgive the jumpiness. There might be jumpiness of showing this video across Zoom, but the audio is really what I want you to pay attention to. It's just a 2-minute clip, but it will very much highlight that indoctrination and might answer the question for you of why Jehovah's Witnesses don't celebrate birthdays.
So, Dad, why don't we celebrate our birthday?
Good question. How would you answer that at school?
Because Jehovah doesn't like it?
Yes, but why? Do you like presents and treats?
Yes!
But do you want them like this? Birthday celebrations mix good things with things Jehovah doesn't like.
How?
Long ago, many people believed in good and evil spirits and were afraid of them. They thought presents and treats on their birthday could protect them. And like today, they made wishes that only good things would happen to them.
What does the Bible say about birthdays?
It talks about them, but not good ones. There was Pharaoh in Egypt and Herod in Jesus' day. They were proud rulers and had people put to death at their birthday parties. Can you remember if Jesus celebrated his birthday?
No.
That's right, he didn't. He told us to celebrate the date of his death because it gives us the hope of living forever. And Jesus taught us to give good things to each other anytime we want. Like today. Good timing.
Hi. Yes.
Okay.
We all live happily ever after.
Y'all, I'm processing this information and this is going to take me a minute. Wow.
There's a wealth of videos like that in that catalog. There's some really disturbing ones that are designed to manipulate the minds of little ones, and it's really quite troubling. Some of them that are just innocent little videos, you can see the expectation is put upon the children in that environment. So yeah, just yeah. If you ever want to get more of an understanding of the environment that Jehovah's Witness youth are raised in, check out all of the videos on there. They've got so many of them.
It just reminded me of my aunt. So this is my mother's oldest sister, whom I'm very close to. She tells me that when I was five, she and Auntie Bev's not a Jehovah's Witness, that I had visited her and she had her Christmas tree up, and this confused me. And that as a five-year-old, I went up to Auntie Bev and said, "You're not a bad person. Why do you have a tree?" I had equated badness with the tree. And that's just 101 indoctrination of Jehovah's Witnesses.
But I can absolutely see how that would happen. I mean, based on just watching this video here, it sounds like they're making children think if you get a birthday present, well, think about birthday presents have spirits and people murder people at their birthday parties. I mean, what? That would be terrifying. I imagine being, 6 years old, walking away from that thinking, well, the other kids at school are having birthday parties. Maybe they kill people at them. I mean, the implication is there.
That's so harmful. And so you can have well-meaning kids who might make you get you a Christmas present or whatever. They might want to share something with you. And they, in innocence, come to you with a little gift for Easter or Christmas. And you're then, as a child, you're in this quandary of, oh, that's nice they thought of me. How beautiful then. But this is an evil present from a worldly person. And how's God going to feel about this? And this is a this is a special territory for me, and I really should be making a good witness to them. Like, it just is a colossal.
And, at school, kids have a birthday party and a slice of cake is given. We would literally throw it in the bin. You'd sometimes have to do that, and you do it in front of the other children. Like, what does that do to a developing young mind? Well, it basically teaches us that everyone else is bad. And sorry, keep going.
So moving things along from childhood, I left home at 19 to serve where the need was greater. That's a very JW term. And so I moved to a congregation about 30 minutes away on the coast of Perth in Scarborough. And it was around this time that I met Sasha. This was actually a really great time of life, I have to say. Yes, I was working part-time 3 days a week trying to support myself as I pioneered and was trying to achieve 90 hours a month every month of witnessing. But I had a really great group of friends at that point in time, and it was fun. Life was fun at that point. And as I say, this is around the time that Sasha and I met. Yes, we met in 94. Now, we talked about earlier in the poll questions about if we've been told to only be interested in someone within the religion. So for Sasha and I, it went a little bit further than that. It wasn't just we were only going to look at someone within the religion. We were only going to look at someone who was in full-time service and who was taking the religion as seriously as we were. So there are a whole lot of Jehovah's Witnesses that I just would never have considered. And likewise for Sasha, what would you say to that, Sasha?
Yeah, exactly right. And I guess that's what gets us to the thrust behind our presentation today, is that that in all of that background and environment meant that we even had to be very judgmental about who we might choose for a romantic relationship. And in the Jehovah's Witness environment, you could not date for any other purpose except with a view to marriage. And so you get in this situation that the moment you express interest in someone, you're basically already married. So there was none of this just dating for the sake of learning, developing, getting to know people, and nothing like that. And of course, within the dating environment, in Jehovah's Witnesses, expressions of affection or anything like that, extremely limited. So here we were in a situation where we basically would choose, almost like an arranged marriage, choose from somebody who was deemed to be the same spiritual standard as us, who was pursuing their spiritual activities and relationship with God and within the organization at the same level. So we might have found other people attractive there, or we might have thought, hey, I'd like to get to know this person. But if they weren't deemed to be of the same spiritual standard, you couldn't do it. You would be judged as bad for looking at someone whose family perhaps only attended the religious services twice a month. Well, obviously you couldn't look at them because you were of a higher standard, or whatever it was. So if they weren't active in the ministry,
they would be viewed as a bad associate. Yeah.
So, I mean, we were in that situation where basically you choose someone to be similar age bracket and your similar spiritual standing.
Wow. So would this be something that was directed by elders in the church or parents? Was there a lot of kind of selecting for people who the appropriate partners would be, or how would
you? Social pressure. It's a lot of social pressure. If I was to look at someone who was not a pioneer and who was working full time, if you're working full time as a youth in the organization, then you are not using your youth in a way to honor God. And you are putting material things first. And why would you put material things first when we are living in the last days and Armageddon's not far off? So you'd be questioning someone's spiritual level, their level of spirituality, if they were not showing by their life decisions that they were serious Jehovah's Witnesses. So a lot of judgment, heaps of judgment. Just so much pressure. So with the J-Dubs, like any other fundamentalist religion, there's a form of purity culture in that there is no sex before marriage. Physical affection is very limited. You have to have a chaperone with you at all times. You're never to be alone together. So it's not the best circumstances with which to get to know one another, but...
And I guess you would definitely say there's a caste system of sorts where you really have to mix with those who are of the same sort of level or standing.
Wow. So this is really kind of hitting me like a ton of bricks now, realizing, you know, what you're saying, the implication seems to be that once you marry someone, that almost the whole entire point of that pairing was for both of you to be equally serious about how you were going to serve the Jehovah's Witness organization. Like this is the entire basis of the relationship.
Right. Exactly. Correct. Exactly. Ooh. And it's a social clique as well. When you're in the social clique of the full-time servants within the organization, it's a totally different structure. It's just, the pressure is incredible and you're all in the know, and it's just really clicky. That's probably the best way I can describe that.
And, you know, other people sort of have asked questions too. What's the purpose of that? Well, you know, is it just to pop out more kids and to keep the organization going? Well, Jehovah's Witnesses have an interesting background with that. For years and years, they discouraged having children. In fact, going back decades and decades, because they would say, now's not the time. Armageddon's coming any day now. This isn't the time to bring children into this evil world. Wait till the new system. So for many years, that was the culture. They've since realized that that's not how you grow a religion. And so they've kind of changed things. And so there is a lot of material presented now for little children. And so they are now encouraging families to have children and raise them in the Lord. And that's how the organization helps to grow, amongst other things. But at our time, when we got married, it was very much discouraged to have a family. And if you did have kids, you were kind of viewed as, well, you weren't taking spirituality seriously because you were distracting yourself with children. And so this whole cognitive dissonance, but aren't children a gift of God? Yes, but they're taking you away from what you should be doing, which is the preaching work.
Even caring for your own children is taking you away from what you're supposed to be doing. Oh, my goodness.
So we made a conscious choice not to have children after we got married.
Wow. Yeah. Speaking of, so
we were married. These photos, you guys, I cannot.
We were babies. Oh, my goodness. We were just... I look back now, we were 24 and we were just so naive, so naive and innocent. But at our wedding, so we had a lot of people within that clique of full-time service at our wedding, and it was expected that we would be a full-time service couple. We did have the opportunity to, if we'd wanted to, go straight into Bethel. Sasha could have stayed at Bethel and then I would have gone in with him, but we decided not to do that. We felt that it would be better for us to spend some time together rather than be in Bethel trying to do the same thing. But life was really difficult. I struggled with working 3 days a week and still trying to do 90 hours a month and be a wife now. And I was just burnt out and exhausted, and it was hard in those first 18 months. And as Sasha mentioned, like menial jobs, he was window cleaning, and I hated the constant struggle of trying to have enough money to pay bills and get by. And so after 18 months, we decided to stop pioneering, which came with a little bit of shame and judgment, because you are now leaving the full-time service group and bubble, and there is a natural kind of soft shunning that even starts at that point. You're no longer in the inner circle, you're no longer part of that clique, so you don't know the latest stuff going on in the organization, and you're judged as not having trusted Jehovah enough to help you get through so that you could really value your privilege of full-time service. God, it triggers me how this language just...
But Jehovah doesn't pay the mortgage or pay the rent.
Right.
So,
he doesn't. No. Who knew?
Another thing or two, I guess, we need to acknowledge is a very much a misogynistic environment that, you know, surprise, surprise, that the religion has. And so there's that constant pressure that I had to be the husbandly head. And whilst I tried to be, you know, kind of caring, I also recognize, looking back now, that I basically thought that I was the head in the relationship. And so I would need to determine the direction and the decisions of our relationship and our family unit and all those sorts of things. And so it created an environment where, rather than working as a strong team, it was kind of like I needed to lead Sherry in the right spiritual way. And the pressure that put on us, and I look back now and I realize, you know, Sherry was struggling with that, with our environment. We're struggling to make ends meet. And then I'm struggling to try and force us to still be the perfect image of the perfect JW couple, and all of those stresses and pressures there. So basically, you know, this outside influence of a high control religion interfering and encroaching into a family unit when it really didn't belong there is something that exists for many in these environments.
Mm. Yeah. Sasha was appointed as a ministerial servant. In fact, he was a servant before we got married, and he was a public speaker, so public talk speaker, which was one of the meetings that they had. So they had 5 meetings a week, and the public talk on the weekend was an hour-long discourse, and Sasha had a few outlines that he had for those talks, and he became a travelling speaker, so he was assigned to go different congregations to speak. And that's why I put wifely role, because all of a sudden I went from being a full-time servant in my own right as a single woman to now being a wife. And the shift is subtle, but it's there and it's present, that all of a sudden my standing within the congregation was no longer as an individual single woman. It was now as a married woman, and it was substantially less. It was now everything channeled through Sasha, which I thought was, you know, the deal. I didn't not like that. I didn't reject it. Now I do, most strenuously. But that's where I saw my place was now. I was in those terms.
Wow.
So things start to change for us. Like we're no longer in full-time service, but Sasha's still a servant. And we start to get older. By our 30s now, we make decisions regarding children. We actually did want to have children. We changed our minds after we'd left full-time service, but unfortunately we weren't able to conceive due to some health issues that I have. And the only way that we would have been able to manage it would have been through IVF. But of course we considered what the organisation said about IVF, which is that it's a conscience matter, that you can have IVF as long as it's the husband's sperm and the wife's egg. However, the concerns are about fertilization and what you do with those embryos. You cannot leave those embryos there. You can't terminate them or destroy them, of course. They believe that life starts at conception. So those are actually lives in their view. And you don't know, of course, in the IVF process, how many embryos you're going to get. So Sasha and I were like, no, we'll just leave it to the new system and have children then.
Wow. So wait, I'm trying to understand. So it would be allowed for people to decide to do IVF, but if you did, would you have to basically like try to use every single one of the Correct. Embryos? Like you, and Correct. So like you could potentially end up being pregnant like indefinitely into the future with all of these embryos.
Right. Right. And you would be judged, you would be spiritually judged if it was known that there were embryos that were destroyed, because yeah, they're very much a anti-abortion organization. Yeah. So yeah. So basically it's kind of, as with many things within the Jehovah's Witness bubble, there might not be a direct ruling, but there'll be a strong cultural implication or guidance as to what your decisions would be. There'll be expressions couched as you saw with the propaganda video for young children. It'd be, now, if you're taking your relationship with God seriously, is that something you would really want to do, brother, sister? You know, that, so you're kind of being led to the conclusion that they want.
Yeah.
So it's the same as the question that you led with at the very beginning of, well, do you really think you should go to your friend's house? And you're supposed to say no.
Correct.
That they don't Correct. Have to tell you. You've been taught to tell yourself no.
You are led to make that decision, but yeah, you're being manipulated the whole time. So we made that decision at that point. And also when you think that you believe that Armageddon's coming and that you're going to have this utopian new system where all of your desires are granted, we just put it off to that. So that was children. Then house ownership was always strongly discouraged as well, because why would you buy in the system that's going to be destroyed? But we got to a point in about 2010 where it actually became silly to not buy a house, because rents were just as expensive as mortgage repayments. So we ended up purchasing a house. And around this same point, so we're, oh goodness, early to mid-30s, mid-30s by this stage, I'm not going to have children. What am I going to do with myself? I looked at starting to pioneer again. But that actually caused a bit of conflict between Sasha and I, because Sasha had started his own business by then and he was relying on me to give him some help in that business. And here I was going off witnessing again from door to door. And so it actually caused conflict, so much so that I had a moment of recognition. There was a kind of a real pinpoint moment for me where I just thought, if pioneering is going to cause conflict with my husband, then I'm not going to pioneer. That Wow. was, it was actually a really pinpoint time for me, that impacted, I believe, then decisions I made later on. But I thought, no. So I just stopped. I just abandoned it. I didn't pioneer anymore. And I then put all of my resources into my career. I was a practice manager for a cancer practice in Sydney, and my employers had offered the opportunity for me to do a university course so that I would be qualified to do my job. And of course, as Sasha mentioned earlier, higher education not really looked at in a good light. Even doing an online course, as I was considering doing, would not be considered good. So Sasha and I kept that very quiet. And as part of my, you know, wifely submission, I actually went to my husband to ask his permission if I could do this course, if I could do the diploma. But all of these factors, all of these things start to become contributing factors to what then later happens. So this is now around 2012, 2013, when I'm doing this course. Unbeknownst to me, this is around the period of time, even a year or two before this, where Sasha is starting to wake up. And I think I will let Sasha say a little bit more before I get to this slide. Do you want to talk about waking up?
Well, I guess recognizing the fact that we're in that environment, that here you were pursuing education for a noble reason to help people through cancer. So I had no problem whatsoever with supporting you in that. I was taken into counselling sessions with the elders in the congregation a couple of times about the fact that I allowed my wife to pursue university education and how that was the wrong thing. And at that time, I would start to stand up to them about that. But I was also doing my own research into the faith. And I guess that's why Sherry says waking up. We use that expression, XJWs are familiar with it, or maybe people from ex-religious cults. I just allowed myself to question, is this faith really the truth, as I'd been told all my life, as Sherry and I were forced to believe, or were there problems with it? So I it's a long story in itself, but I had started to go down the rabbit hole of researching the origins of the religion. I recognized that the religion was extremely problematic. And yet here I was still in a leadership role in the congregation, encouraging others to pursue all of the Jehovah's Witness activity. But I started to have cognitive dissonance about so many aspects of it. I then allowed myself to recognize that this can't be God's one true organization. And then I had to do the next step, which is analyze. Well, once I'd analyzed the religion, I analyzed the book on which they claim to be based, you know, the Bible, and realized that the Bible was problematic and that the personality of God is extremely problematic. And so I started to recognize that here I was, here was Sherry, here's all of these wonderful people who are saying that we're created in the image of God, and yet God is a problematic character who's okay with misogyny and slavery and homophobia and genocide and incest and, you know, worldwide violence and all these sorts of things that we see in the Bible. And that's completely opposite to who we try and be as people. So I saw myself in a situation there where I didn't think this was true, but I felt trapped in this religious bubble. But I also couldn't go to Sherry and say, hey, I think the religion's wrong and I think the Bible's problematic and I think the personality of God is problematic. And hey, is there even a God? I couldn't go to Sherry and ask those questions. So there was a couple of year period where we kind of had to navigate this, where playing the role of still being within the religion, but I don't really believe, but I can't actually raise that to Sherry. So instead, what I did was just supported everything that she was focused upon. I supported her education. I supported her career. I never judged anything that she wasn't doing within the religious environment. And just created this calm environment, as she's put in the slide there, where rather than focusing our relationship as we'd previously done upon the religion and all of the religious activities, I shifted the focus to supporting her, supporting us as a couple, and just kind of just changing what it was that was the foundation of our relationship. I would occasionally drop comments to her about problematic aspects of the religion, what they were teaching at the meetings, or maybe something from the Bible. I might occasionally go, look, I was just reading this passage of the Bible and this is a bit disturbing. Did you know Lot, and you know, we know the story of Lot, but did you see the rest of the story? I don't remember the congregation ever teaching us about what else happened. And I just drop it and then say, anyway, let's go for a walk, or let's go off and have dinner or something and change the subject.
Meanwhile, so, he just walks off, you know, oh well, whatever, I'll go to something. I'm in the meantime going, holy crap. I don't know what to respond to that. I haven't thought of that before, but I didn't know what to do with any of it at this stage. Well, as this I say, all I saw was that Sasha was happy. He was supportive. If I couldn't make a meeting, he never made me feel bad about it. He was just like, no. And then he would tell me, because I knew what would happen at the meeting if I didn't turn up. Sasha would get the, oh, is Sherry not well? Is she okay? Because, you know, you're not there. Because there's no reason that you wouldn't be there unless you're on death's door. And Sasha would flip that on its head and say to them, oh, no, she's great, thank you, but, you know, I'm so proud of Sherry. She's doing a fantastic job helping people with cancer. They couldn't say anything to this. And then Sasha would tell me that he was defending me at the hall. So I think this is something that I wanted to get across in this talk to others. If you are in this situation, if you are no longer believing and you don't know what to do with your spouse, I recommend this, where Sasha was just loving and happy and let's go and spend time together. Let's go to a football game. Let's do this. Let's do that. As I said, I threw everything into my career, and I've got the photo there of the two surgeons that I worked for, who were, well, Prof Thompson basically wrote the book on how to treat melanoma. He's just world-renowned and incredible academic. And I just loved working with them and learning as much as I could from them. And so I participated in a lot of the activities and events that the charity was putting on, and Sasha came along and supported all of that. It just meant so much to me, even though I knew that others in the congregation would be judging that. You know, why would you be involved in a charity when, you know, only God's kingdom is going to solve the problem of melanoma? So it was constant judgment, but Sasha never, he didn't buy into that at this stage. He was just supportive and just created this environment at home that gave me the space I needed to be able to think and sort of try to come to terms with things as best as I could. However, Sasha did not get opportunity to, I suppose, you know, where was it going to lead? At some point, something was going to have to happen. It all came apart on this day. We had a staff member. I mentioned Sasha had his own business. And in order for me to work full time and do this diploma and all the stuff that I was doing, employed one of the young witnesses in the congregation who was also a regular pioneer to do the bookkeeping for Sasha so that I didn't have to do it, created some time, blah, 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 blah. She, on this particular day, fossicked around on Sasha's work computer and discovered that Sasha had not logged out of a extra Jehovah's Witness forum. He was on an apostate website. And she saw his username and some of the comments that he had been commenting. And by this point in time, Sasha is well and truly out and awake. He is an atheist. He is, I think, how many posts did you have by this point? Was it 4,000? Something ridiculous, right?
Yeah.
Something ridiculous that was on there.
Now, Sherry, so, did you know at this point that he was out?
No. No. In fact, it had only been in the January of 2015 that Sasha was no longer a ministerial servant. So right up until this time, he was still a servant in the congregation. So I had no idea about this at all.
And that I think goes to your question there, Cara, is that, and what I had tried to do with that whole creating a safe space and a reframing the foundation of our relationship, I kind of had not an end game, but my motive was to get to a point where it was safe for me to say to Sherry, I don't believe this faith anymore, and we could have a comfortable conversation without her having a reflexive response that the religion would have encouraged, which was, hey, I'm going to leave you and our relationship's busted. So I kind of thought that that was paving a safe space. What happened here, what Sherry's saying, is kind of it hijacked that process that I was trying for. Mm-hmm. So no matter how well you try and plan for things, something came up. And yeah, look, being exposed as somebody who's researching apostate or non-Jehovah's Witness approved material is worse than anything else you can do within that religious bubble. So that's basically why this happened so quickly. It wasn't how I planned for things to happen.
Yeah, you were playing the strategic long game and then it got accelerated. Yep. Okay. Yep. Tell me what happened.
So that was a really difficult weekend. So after she discovered this, she went straight to the elders and reported it to the elders. She didn't come and tell Sasha or myself, but just went straight to the elders. And then so this was on the Friday, the 5th. On Saturday, the 6th, she called us up in the afternoon and said that she was resigning. She'd been working for us for about 3 years at this point. And this came out of the blue. We were just shocked that she was resigning. And Sasha asked her on the phone call, why? And she said to him, you know why. And then hung up.
You were listening to the phone call. Yeah.
I'm here the whole call, right? And I'm like, you know what? What is going on here? Sasha tries calling her back several times. She doesn't answer. And so Sasha eventually then calls her father, who's one of the elders in the congregation, and he tells Sasha that, and by the way, this phone call was not on speaker. Sasha's having the call with the elder. I can't hear what the elder's saying, but I'm present, I'm there. I'm watching Sasha's face. And Sasha's talking to this elder. The elder says to him, we are so upset, we're all very distressed. You've been on apostate websites, and we had to have an emergency elders meeting this morning over this. And Sasha's just watching me as he's responding to this elder. They eventually got off the phone call, and now Sasha has to tell me what's happened, that she's resigned because she discovered that he was on a ex-Jehovah's Witness forum. And this is how I learn my husband doesn't believe in the J-Dub religion anymore. Why are you on this site of ex-Jehovah's Witnesses? So that weekend, it was exquisitely painful for both of us. I'm terrified because I don't know what our relationship now rests on. What does this actually mean for us, for our future? If he no longer believes in the religion, then what's it actually based on? Where are the boundaries? Where are the parameters? But I don't know how to word it that way at this stage. I'm just feeling a whole lot of emotions and really not sure what to do. And Sasha's trying to be as honest with me as he can, but he can see that I'm like, what the hell? It was a really difficult weekend. At the same time, the elders were on the attack. They were trying to bring Sasha to heel, and they wanted to have a meeting with him, so two elders to meet with him to discuss all of this. And both Sasha and I knew that if that meeting went ahead, he would end up disfellowshipped out of the congregation, and that would really put a lot of pressure on me then as to what would I do, because this is the one circumstance that a Jehovah's Witness woman can leave a marriage and have the full support of the congregation.
Oh, apart from infidelity as well.
But even with infidelity, even with infidelity, it's okay, they will, it's slightly different, I feel. Apostasy is just such a clear cut.
So in Jehovah's Witness world, the only two reasons you can separate a relationship is adultery, or if one is deemed a spiritual threat, apostasy. So here was a situation where Sherry would have been told that she had the blessing of the congregation, the organization, to leave because I was a spiritual threat to her.
Okay, yeah. I'm not going to ask Sherry this question that's in my head right now, but Sasha, I'm going to ask you, were you worried that she would leave you if this happened, if you were disfellowshipped?
Yes. At that point in time, Kara, that weekend, I thought everything was over. I just assumed at that point, and it was wrong of me because, you know, I should have trusted Sherry to make her own decision. But at that point, I thought, that's it. Our whole relationship is over because of our whole, and I guess that's why we spent so much time with our background of indoctrination and upbringing. That is what should have happened. That's how the script plays out. And so I assumed, well, that's it. We're going to have to divorce and separate and go, you know, our own way and life's over. And what I am grateful for, though, in that moment is the fact that we had a couple of years period where I was able to slowly shift the foundation of our relationship from the JW activity to focusing upon what it was that was important to us, Sherry's career, education, and the things that drew us together. I'm grateful for that time period of transition because it then put us in a position where at least we could have some open communication, where at least we can discuss things together without it being a knee-jerk reaction.
Mm-hmm. Wow. Okay. And Sherry, tell me, I'm on the edge. I know how this ends and I'm still like, my stomach is in knots right now. Sherry, what was going through your head at this
time? I was just terrified. I was so scared. I'm asking him these questions and I'm scared to hear how he's going to respond. We talk about, you know, Armageddon. We talk about the new paradise, the new system, and Sasha's letting me know as gently as he can that he doesn't believe this and that he finds it all very problematic. And, you know, he's saying things like, so what, the person next door gets killed in Armageddon just because they said no to taking a watchtower and awake? And there's a certain amount of logic to what he said, but I was so indoctrinated at this point that I responded with things like, that's something a 16-year-old would say. Like, you are expressing doubts that a teenager would come up with, not someone in their mid-30s.
Possibly a teenager who was going to subsequently leave the faith.
Right.
Yeah.
Right. So,
I would say to Sherry, why should a 2-year-old child be killed because their parents said no thank you to us on a Saturday morning when we knocked on their door? Why does that child deserve to die? And I would just do a lot of those questions. I'd say, how do we know that we've got the truth? Like, why are we so convinced that this is the one true religion? And so Sherry was in this position where she was just really worried about, well, who was I? Because she didn't know, you know, and I had to reassure her that I am the same person. She's turning to me and asking questions like, are you going to start smoking now? Are you going to start swearing? Will you start celebrating Christmas? You know, and I understand that's because that's the thing she was told would make you a bad person. And so I was able to reassure her that I'm exactly the same person. In fact, in many ways, I'm probably trying to be a better person because I'm able to come to a lot of my moral foundations or ethical foundations, not based upon the Bible or the religion that we were part of, but based upon who we are. But trying to have that conversation in the midst of upheaval of emotions was difficult.
Yeah, really hard. And then I realized I had to ask him some bigger questions on what he actually thought about the Bible and what did he think about God. And so to learn in this weekend, I learned not only that he no longer believed in the Jehovah's Witness religion, but that he didn't believe there was a God and he didn't believe that the Bible was God's word. So just everything I felt like the carpet had been ripped out from under my feet and I didn't know which way was up. But what I did know is that I was not going to cope going to meetings by myself without him. I knew I couldn't do the spiritual widow thing because I just would have been really cranky at anyone coming up giving me fake sympathy of, I'm so sorry to hear what's happened to Sasha and how are you coping? I knew that I would react quite aggressively to that because I felt for Sasha. I felt like he was... What he was showing me that weekend was someone who was obviously extremely distressed and upset about the situation. He was just as unsure as I was as to what it actually meant for our marriage. And I hated seeing him in that kind of turmoil and distress. And I wasn't going to hop on the bandwagon of, you know, saying anything negative about him. It just, it was a really challenging week. And so throughout the following week, the girl that had dobbed Sasha in, she did one day a week of work for Sasha with his business. I gave her work at the medical practice. So on the Monday when I went back to work, who did I have to face but her? And that was really challenging for me. She remained an employee of the practice for about another 8 or 9 months before she resigned. So that was super challenging to have to deal with that. But we went to one meeting afterwards. Sorry, you want to say something then, Sasha?
No, you go ahead.
Okay. We went to one meeting the following week. So the next weekend after the 6th of June, we went to a meeting. And I've never felt so uncomfortable in a Kingdom Hall in all my life than that meeting, because it was very clear that the Jehovah's Witness grapevine had gone into overtime. It was such hot, salacious gossip that Sasha had been found out to be an apostate. You could tell everybody had been talking about it. You know, that silence when you walk into the room and the shifty glances, and that was all happening. And nobody was coming up to me at all. No. We had an elder who came up, and he basically, I realized after the meeting when he came up again, once the meeting had finished, he was actually on guard duty, watching Sasha, wanting to make sure that nobody came up and was influenced by him.
Oh, you're already a threat. You might, you know, influence people with your satanic idea. Wow.
Yeah. Sasha's a threat.
Yeah.
So one thing I'm sorry.
Go ahead. No, go ahead, Sasha.
One thing I'm grateful for is that through this process, so here was Sherry in a situation where, were there more slides, Sherry, or was that the last
one? Oh, yeah, no, there are more.
Okay. Here you were in a position where you didn't judge me straight away, and you recognised that this, you know, I was trying to be the best husband I could be, and our relationship was based not upon the religious environment but upon us. And I'm really grateful in that time that you didn't just throw me away based upon what the religion was telling you, that the religion was saying this person is a threat, but you were saying, but I know who he is, you know, I know what our relationship can be based upon and who we are. So I'm really grateful for that, and I know a lot of people in this situation will go through similar things or have gone through similar things where their spouse didn't give them, or their partner didn't give them the benefit of the doubt, didn't look at who the person really was, but looked at the image or what they were being told the person was. So I'm really appreciative that you were patient enough to go through that with me.
Well, I think at the end of the day, our marriage was based on more than the religion. We care for each other. We love each other. And I didn't like seeing how the religion was treating you and the distress it was causing you. And I also didn't like how the religion treated me, because I became collateral damage and nobody contacted me to see how I was. I was just given up. And I knew that the only way I would get support from the organisation was if I continued to be active. If I continued to go to meetings and be present, then I would get some form of support. But I couldn't bring myself to do that because of what I'd already said.
But it needs to be acknowledged too that I was more than happy to support you. If you had said to me, I still believe that this is God's true religion and I still want to be a member, I made it clear that, well, that's fine, you do you and I'll do me. Like, I, there was no expectation that, well, I've come to these conclusions, therefore you need to adopt mine. And I'm grateful for that, because we came from a background where I had to set the lead and you were going to have to do what it was that I said in the family, because that's the religious mindset. I was more than happy to say, you can exist in your belief structure and I can exist in mine, but we can still have a close relationship. Mm-hmm. And I think the power of it is your waking up process, as you'll go into here, was your own process. It was not because I've determined that that's what you have to believe, and if I'm atheist, you have to be atheist. It was none of that.
And so in the 18 months since that 2015 event, we just focused on ourselves. We focused on our marriage. We spent time together. We went to music concerts. We went for drives. We went away for weekends. We just spent time with each other. And Sasha never once pressured me on anything. Like he didn't, and he didn't burden me with anything that he was thinking or feeling as far as the religion was concerned. He was still incredibly active on that ex-Jehovah's Witness forum. He offered to show me. He, you know, sat me down and he got to the front page of the website. I'm like, I couldn't see anymore. My alarm bells were ringing mad and I'm like, no, I can't look at it. It's apostate, it's apostate, it's apostate. So it took me so long to finally get the courage to analyze the religion for myself. And it was when this report was released. So the report was released on the 28th of November, 2016. I happened to be at an airport and had an hour to kill while waiting for my flight. Sasha said, why don't you read the report? I made a joke about, no, it'll make me angry, and then looked up the report and read it. And reading this, like that particular report, It was safe in that it wasn't apostate. It wasn't from, it was a government. So I knew that it was going to be non-emotive, not about bitterness, not trying to tear down a religion, but trying to care for children. And so as I read it and saw how bad the organization had been, I was mortified and realized, why does it take Satan's organization to tell God's organization how to protect children? There's something wrong. Something really wrong. And so Sasha didn't know that I was actually reading the report. When I got home from work that night, I walked in the door and I just said, it's not the truth.
As in the religion is not the truth.
Religion is not the truth.
All of these things have proven that it cannot possibly be God's one true organization.
So it was a period of time where we did have different beliefs. We had different, when we just didn't, I didn't talk about it because I was too scared. I didn't have the mental headspace to really think about it. I just got involved in life and let work and spending time with my husband take everything up. Not until this happened. And once I read this and had the realization it's not the truth, then everything started to crumble down pretty quickly after that. And I do realize that I was in a very privileged position because as I came out and woke up, I had Sasha's support. He never at any point went, now that you know this, how about this, this, and this? He let me find it for myself. All he did was say, you might find this website useful. You might find this book useful. You might find this podcast or YouTube, whatever. You find it yourself. And so he let me then take ownership of my own process and just was there to support it. So as I started to go down that rabbit hole and just compulsively just watching and consuming as much information as I could and learning all of these things. Did you know 607 wasn't even the year that Jerusalem was destroyed? And Sasha would just be like, yep. it was tumultuous for me, but I'm incredibly grateful that Sasha was there as a soft landing place for me in the immediate. A lot of people don't have that.
Go ahead.
A lot of people don't have that. A lot of people, they've got to try to blunder through this on their own. And even worse, they have a hostile spouse.
Yeah.
And that's really, really difficult to deal with. And I do very much feel for people in those circumstances. Moving on to 2017, though, now that I was awake, it was all about the firsts, you know, doing the things that we never could do. And I now was like damn it, if it was something I couldn't do, I'm damn well doing it. So I did it all. 2017 was just a wild year. We went to Skepticon, which was just amazing. We said that's like our new annual convention now. first Halloween, which we got super involved in. Sasha dressed the house and did all this stuff.
Birthday, best time of the year.
Yeah, that's it. Birthday, which of course now you'll all understand why we have a beheaded head on a platter, because no Jehovah's Witness, ex-Jehovah's Witness birthday is actually a true birthday unless there is a beheading. So we embrace that. And
well, that's what we were taught as children growing up, that the only birthdays in the Bible had people beheaded, John the Baptist, therefore birthdays wrong. So this was a great slap in the face of that.
Yeah, and it really was a perfect present because it deals wonderfully with Halloween. I mean, hey, it's fantastic. and we had our first Christmas in 2017 just for the sake of having a tree and presents and just enjoying it. After we get through the firsts, Sasha and I, our focus then changes and we shift into wanting to use our experience in a way to help other people and to be soft landing places for them. And that leads us to organising an event in 2019 where we had, I think at this stage, it's the largest ex-Jehovah's Witness gathering in Australia. We had 134 ex-Jehovah's Witnesses across Australia and New Zealand. We also had some of the most well-known ex-Jehovah's Witness activists come along from the US and Europe, which was really quite incredible. We had a film crew from Los Angeles and the most amazing of amazing of amazing. This photo here where Sasha's handing a gift, that gentleman there, he's a federal justice now, but at the time of the Australian Royal Commission, he was the senior counsel for the Royal Commission, and he just is, he's a superhero to all of us ex-Jehovah's Witnesses because the way that he studied and researched and learned all about the religion to understand the mechanisms of harm with child abuse. He even had one of the governing body members on the stand and he questioned him for an hour and a half. And it just, for XJ Dubs, Angus Stewart is a hero. And to have him come along that day was just outstanding. After that day, Sasha and I were then, well, we still want to help people. So what can we do now? And that's when we learned about recovering from religion. And early in 2020, I became a volunteer and went through the support group leader training and we started the very first Sydney Australia group. And it's been absolutely an incredible group right from the very beginning. 18th of April was our first meeting. It's always been on Zoom due to COVID, but we always get about 20 to 30 coming along. And we have two meetings now, which are just wonderful. I love the support groups. In January 21, we brought together other RFR Australian volunteers to form a leadership group so that we could raise awareness about religious trauma and also raise the profile of recovering from religion, get more people to become volunteers, make sure more people know about the services so that they can get support. And through that, we have done a media release and had quite a few newspaper articles or online articles, magazine articles, again, to really promote recovering from religion. This year, we had, we were on national TV a few weeks ago, which was quite something. Unfortunately, they didn't mention recovering from religion, which didn't get edited in, unfortunately, but our story certainly was getting out there. And in February this year, I was appointed an honorary fellow with one of the universities here in Sydney so that we can, along with recovering from religion, we can have events, speaking events, where we can get academics and mental health professionals and cult survivors, lawmakers, policymakers, media, as many people that this subject touches on, come together and have discussions on this and look at what we can do to improve the situation, provide support, but also make organizations accountable for the trauma that they inflict. So there's lots of exciting things now happening from the experiences that Sasha and I have had. We both love working along with Recovering From Religion. I'm thrilled that I'm on the board now, have been on the board for 18 months and absolutely loving it. And the International Development Director, helping other countries that also want to do the same thing. We've got a group in New Zealand forming. I've got contacts now in other countries across the world that are also wanting to do similar things. So I have a small team of two other RFI volunteers helping me just with that, of reaching out to other internationals. Sasha, you say before I talk about next year.
I guess it could well be said that we've gone from a background where we were actively preaching to try and force people into our religious environment to a background, to a complete about circle, where we're active in just supporting other people to be whoever they want to be, to become your best, most authentic self. And the work that we're doing with Recovering From Religion is kind of like the beautiful neat bow on the end of that, to tie up that whole story and to tie things up to really where we should be, living an authentic life, supporting other people. So we absolutely love being able to just completely flip the script of our life.
Yeah, Sasha, I love how you put that, as the kind of just putting a bow on it at the end, because it sounds to me like that what you said about just helping people to live their most authentic lives is exactly what both of you were doing all along in your own relationship as well. And that's why you were able to get past all of that. And that is just incredible. Y'all, this has been incredible. And I know we've gone over time a little bit, but I didn't even want to stop you because this is just such an amazing story. Thank you so much for sharing this. Oh my goodness.
So my last slide is to encourage or invite everybody to come to Sydney next year, because we are applying to march in the parade on September 25th in February for the Sydney Gay and Lesbian Mardi Gras. And next year it combines with World Pride. It's the first time World Pride is coming to the Southern Hemisphere. And so it's all happening in this one event. And we have the wonderful Dr. Daryl Ray and Gail Jordan coming to Australia as well. So we're all going to be marching in this. We've got a few other, I think Phil Sessions is going to come and Dave Klinging is going to come, and we just want this to be the best. It's going to be incredible. And at the same time, the university appointment I spoke of with a speaking event, we're pivoting that event around Gail and Daryl's visit here so that we can just tie it all together. So incredibly excited for next year. I'm in contact with a lot of other academics who will also be participating in the speaking event around this time. So if you don't have plans next year and you want to get out because, hey, you know, COVID's just stopped everything, I think this is a wonderful opportunity to come down and spend some time with us. And that is the end of my presentation.
Sherry, thank you so much. That was incredible. I'm stunned and amazed, and I'm definitely going to this event. Do not let us forget about this. Like, keep reminding us. This is incredible. I'm speechless, which doesn't happen to me that often. You're welcome, everyone. Okay. And yes, that was fantastic. And that was perfect. I'm so glad you shared all of that with us. And we have loads of questions. We don't have time to get through very many of them because we got to wrap up, but this has been fascinating. The chat is just going, it's off the chain. There are so many questions. I can't get to all of them, but let me just ask you a couple of them. Someone was asking now, and I love this question, what's been the best part of your lives post Jehovah's Witness? How did everything change?
For me, the best part has been getting to know myself and letting myself explore my own potential to be what I want to be. And Arafat is a very large part of that, because I had never had any grand plans to be on a board or plan to take an organization globally, or, you know, all these things that I'm currently doing, I would never have thought of doing for myself. And it just developing leadership qualities and being able to inspire or help other people in this way and let myself develop and become more. I'm loving that journey. And I have to say that for me, that's probably the best part of this whole process, is just being able to push myself past previous boundaries and let myself run riot. And I'm just loving it. I love it.
And I would add to that too, the fact that we're no longer living with that, in that fear, obligation and guilt bubble that religion saddles so many of us in, that we're able to be our authentic selves outside of that bubble. And that is so empowering. And you know, for so many of us that are part of the RFR family or community, we recognize that now we're able to actually live without any oppression and live an authentic, happy life outside of that fear, obligation and guilt.
Yeah, life's amazing. Life is fantastic. And we now appreciate today, we appreciate now, we value the present, and we're not living for some utopian something that's never going to happen. We channel David Warnock and seize the fucking day.
Carpe the fucking diem. That's it. Yes.
And on that note, I can't think of a better way to wrap up this episode. Thank you so much, both of you. This is just incredibly inspiring. I don't even know what to say. This is fantastic. This is the best episode ever. Just kidding. They're all amazing.
Yeah.
This is just fantastic.
Recovering from Religion is a nonprofit organization whose mission it is to provide hope, healing, and support to those struggling with issues of doubt and non-belief. Hope, healing, and support is waiting for you on our website, recoveringfromreligion.org. There you can speak or chat with a trained agent who will work with you through your struggles and doubts, or to help find resources that may work for you. You can also find local Recovering from Religion support groups in your area for the long-term recovery work. Resources specifically curated for those struggling with doubts, disbelief, and trauma can also be found on the RFR website. To connect with a secular therapist in your area, go to seculartherapy.org and create an account. If you'd like to support the work that RFR does, you can donate or sign up as a volunteer on the Recovering from Religion website. It's also a big help subscribing to the RFR YouTube channel, our blog, or following us on Facebook, Twitter, and Instagram. Questions, comments, and suggestions can be emailed to us at rfrx@recoveringfromreligion.org. Thanks for tuning in, and we hope you'll be with us next time on the Recovering from Religion podcast.